Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association, or JOMA, podcast. I'm your host, Elisa Minkin. I am a general pediatrician, and I'm really honored and excited to be here today with Dr. Michelle Conti. Hi.
Hi. Nice to be here with you.
Thank you so much for doing this with me.
Of course.
Dr. Conti received her doctorate at LIU Post Clinical Psychology Doctoral Program, where she focused her work with children and families. She completed a postdoctoral fellowship specializing in child clinical psychology and developmental disabilities at Westchester Institute for Human Development. She completed her predoctoral internship at the Early Childhood Center at Einstein, where she was trained in parent-child therapy and early childhood development. Dr. Conti has trained in a range of clinical settings, including schools, inpatient psychiatric units, UCEDDS, what is that?
You said they're university centers for excellence in developmental disabilities.
Oh, that's cool. Mm-hmm. And outpatient clinics. Her goal was to experience the full range of development from early childhood to emerging adulthood. Dr. Conti's work with children, adolescents, families, and young adults centers on cognitive behavior therapy techniques, as well as a family systems-based collaborative approach in order to increase positive family interactions and improve daily functioning. She has a private clinical practice in Oceanside where she offers individual, family, and group psychotherapy. And I have to say that the reason that I'm talking to Dr. Conti today is because I practice pediatrics in Oceanside and Dr. Conti is our go-to psychologist, especially for anxiety. So we thank you so much for helping our patients.
Oh, and thank you for the referrals. And I hear such great things about everyone, you know, as far as your practice as well. So it's a great collaboration that we have.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I practice at Beach Pediatrics, which is a subsidiary of Allied Pediatrics. I'm going to give your number and your email. Is that how you want to be reached?
Yes, sure.
Okay. So a phone number is 516-415-2180. And the email is M as in Mary, Conti, C as in Cookie, O as in Oscar, N as in Nancy, T as in Tommy, I is an ice cream, psych. That's all one word, mcontipsych@gmail.com. And so I thank you so much for doing this with me.
Yes, of course. I'm happy to be here. It's such an important topic, especially now.
Yes, it really is. So let's first just start with the basic definition. We're talking about children. We're talking about anxiety in children. What is that?
Well, you know, it's important to note too that some levels of anxiety, what we call anxiety, right, or worry, is kind of normal, right? I mean, we all kind of need a level of worry to get things done and you know, for children to study and kind of be on point with things. It becomes, you know, what we would describe as a clinical level of anxiety that would be diagnosable when, you know, it's really affecting an area or multiple areas of functioning for a child. So, you know, excessive worry, avoidance of situations, whether that be school or, you know, socialization, or it's affecting sleep or eating habits, right? So if it's really affecting the child's life and all, of course, the family's life, then that's when we're concerned that, you know, this is now something that's diagnosable and probably needs treatment. But, you know, a healthy level of anxiety is okay, you know, for most people, you know, but it just gets to a certain point where it becomes, it interferes in things that a child wants to do or an adolescent or, you know, or anyone really.
Right. So when you talk about domains of function, right, you mentioned school, you mentioned social with friends, everybody is aware of those. I, as a pediatrician, see it often affecting the home situation more than anything, as if they're the parents see it, they're more comfortable to show what they're dealing with at home, but it's not seen elsewhere.
Yes. Yes. That happens commonly. You know, children and teens especially are very good at masking this sort of thing, or they're not really talking so much about their worries or their thoughts, especially in school or with friends. You know, and that's pretty concerning because we want to be able to understand what's going on underneath the surface. We might see a lot of avoidance behaviors, irritability, you know, just excessive, you know, worry or reassurance seeking, asking a lot of questions and things like that. And but we might not really understand what's underneath that. So a lot of times parents are dealing with sort of behaviors. It could even reach the, you know, I see a lot of kids that it reaches a level of tantrum behaviors at home, right? Because maybe something unexpected came up or things changed or, you know, schedules are different. Something happened that they didn't like or want to happen or couldn't do something that they wanted. And that will, you know, lead to a tantrum, but it's not because of necessarily a behavioral issue. There's underlying worry or anxiety there.
And I think also you would see it more in the younger children. I mean, those, when you talk about tantrums, you're usually talking about the youngest children. I think it's trickier as they go into preteens and adolescents, you know, where they're more often, you know, in their room or with their friends, and you really don't even see what's going on. Because I pick it up all the time that children have, older kids have anxiety and the parents weren't even aware a lot of the time.
Right. Well, because many times with teens, it can look sort of like what we would think of as, you know, sort of typical teenage behavior. Like they're isolated, they're in their room a lot, you know, they're not going out. But really, we have to kind of look at that and understand, are they connecting with peers? You know, are they getting invited to you know, things, but they're choosing not to go? You know, what is really going on under that, you know? And if there is that sense of, you know, extreme avoidance of many different, you know, situations, then we probably are looking at some anxiety there. And it's important to help teens especially be able to discuss that and, you know, learn to kind of face that, tolerate it, you know, because ultimately we don't want that to get to the level where it's really affecting them, you know, in terms of going to school at all or being successful in school, or they don't, you know, their social life is non-existent. You know, so then we really have to look at, you know, helping them to bring that out. And we don't want it to ultimately lead to depression, which can happen often with teens and anxiety.
Right. I always say anxiety and depression go together like peanut butter and jelly. They're very often associated together. I want to just go back a little bit before we go into subtypes of anxiety. Mm-hmm. First of all, just to mention before I forget that we are still in a pandemic, and I think it's so much harder to tell what's normal and what's not because, you know, we had so much fear of the pandemic, fear of the COVID, you know, and where it can be normal to stay home. So it can be so much harder to say, you know, is a teen isolating? I mean, what if they have nowhere to go because their friends aren't getting together as much, and they're in an area where people are being more careful. I'm just throwing it out there that it can be harder now to tell.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And I think, you know, over the course of really that period of, you know, intense quarantine and isolation that we were all in last year, you know, I definitely think there were kids, you know, involved in their teens that, you know, it's hard to tell. Is this just them staying home because everyone's home, or is it they're really isolating themselves and not even reaching out with friends? You know, it's also an interesting question of, you know, sometimes I've heard, you know, or parents ask me, like, you know, does all the technology and social media and things like that, does this like lead to more anxiety and depression? Is this what's kind of causing this increase in kids dealing with these issues? But, you know, it's kind of, it's tricky because it's like, I know, especially with COVID, right? I mean, that was kind of the only way that many kids connected with their peers was, you know, via social media or online gaming or things like that. And even just being connected to their peers in their classrooms online, you know, and being able to chat with them that way. So it's hard to say that, you know, what relationship that may have had. It may have helped in certain situations, and it may not help with other kids in other situations if that's the only way they're relying on, you know, their interaction with their peers. Certainly we want to see at least attempts to be more well-rounded. And as, of course, things have opened up more, right, you know, school and even activities, sports, right? The summertime, lots of kids were at camp and outdoors and doing some great activities. And, you know, we want to just look at the quality of those interactions or if they're just avoiding those interactions. If they're getting very worried about seeing friends or, you know, playing soccer again after maybe not having played for a long time or things like that, you know, and for teens, it's, you know, how much are they kind of bouncing back to maybe a more typical level of, you know, making plans with their friends on the weekends or kind of gathering after school or something like that, you know, or are they less willing to start, you know, organized sports or after school clubs, you know? So obviously their level of participation in things is going to be a big factor. You know, but we always want to be aware of in addition to that, besides that, when they are at home, you know, how much interaction are they having with friends, you know? And of course there has to be ideally a balance, right? Cause many kids could be up late at night talking on the phone or FaceTime or things like that. But, you know, we want to understand what's going on when they are at home. Is it really, are they completely isolated and don't have connections to other kids, or, you know, are they keeping in touch, you know, while they're kind of at home being safe in certain ways? So it is definitely tricky with the current climate. I think it just takes a little bit of delving deeper or underneath and seeing what the quality of those interactions are.
Right. You know, I have so many thoughts about what you said. There's so much there to unpack. I want to talk about a couple of things, but first I just want to mention that what I've seen of the kids who have more of a social anxiety, and we're going to define the different types in a few minutes, that some of them have said to me, this was great. This pandemic was great. Mm-hmm. You know, they had less demands on their, you know, socialization skills.
Yes.
And, you know, there was a meme that says introvert. This is what I've been waiting for my whole life. and now they're being asked to do it again. And not only was it always harder for them, but it's that much harder because their socialization muscles have been atrophied.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. They were, you know, able to kind of take that time to not really have to have those sort of pressures or those situations that naturally came up that they would have to kind of deal with. Even with kids, you know, I've been hearing from kids who aren't even struggling with anxiety now, but just going back to school in person now, you know, it's just a different level of sort of, they have to be on, they have to be paying attention, they have to be focused, they have to be, I have to talk to some peers in my class, I have to talk to my teachers again. It's just, it's kind of a shock, you know, back to normal, you know, quote unquote, normal life and a normal routine. And for kids who are socially anxious, yeah, of course it's even more so,
right.
You know, but it's definitely, important to distinguish though, between, I don't know if you want to talk about this now, but you know, the differences between social anxiety and maybe what we would think of as shyness or introversion.
Right. I do. I want to go through everything, but I want to go back a little bit because I just want to make sure to go over the concept of how do we know something's a problem? We talked about it, you know, in pretty general terms, but it can be really confusing that, you know, one child, you know, maybe it will look like a typical teenager isolating in the room, and for another child, they really are suffering. So I just want to mention those domains of frequency, intensity, and duration. And if you could explain, you know, how that differentiates a problem from a non-problem.
I mean, you know, I think overall looking at different areas, so, you know, we want to look at, again, how's their social interaction, interacting with friends, are they going out of the house? But it's more than just that too, right? It's like, if you're at the dinner table, are they, you know, involved in a discussion? Are they kind of, you know, just kind of sticking to themselves? Do they not want to come down for dinner? Are they not coming out of their room at all? You know, are they excessively sleeping or telling you that they're up all night, you know? So their sleep patterns are affected, you know, and again, in terms of the frequency and the, you know, the severity, these would have to be things that are happening on, you know, a very frequent basis, maybe like several times a week. You know, every teenager, I think, struggles with sleep or being isolated, but it would have to be something that's almost on a daily basis, you know, that parents start to wonder, you know, what could be going on. And, you know, oftentimes it is difficult to distinguish, but I think overall we have to look at the different levels of functioning. Eating habits also affected. Are they eating too much? Are they eating not enough? Right. Are they not barely coming out of their room to eat, you know, a meal? As far as school, you know, if you have a child that was, you know, doing fairly well, are their grades slipping? Are they just not you know, completing schoolwork, you know, are they not wanting to go to school for certain reasons? You know, with teenagers, there can be a level of school refusal, but it feels a little different than it would be with younger kids. So they can come up with sort of these reasons why they might not want to go to school or things like that, that might sound like kind of rational sometimes, but we have to understand why that might be the case. You know, why would they be avoiding something? Are they avoiding a social interaction? Are they avoiding schoolwork? You know, and sort of the pressures of that. I think too, a lot of teens that I've treated with anxiety have presented with these levels of perfectionism, mm-hmm. right? So they're so worried about their performance in all areas of functioning, whether it's like, you know, again, socially, how often am I going out with my friends? How often am I talking to my friends? I'm not getting hundreds or A's on my tests and that's unacceptable. You know, I'm not the best on my soccer team. You know, it's a lot of pressure that they're putting on themselves. And in some ways those teens and kids, younger kids too, can be very functional, you know, actually, because they're doing all these activities and they're doing all these things. But there's an emotional component to it that they don't seem to be as maybe fulfilled or happy by these things that maybe did make them happy before. You know, and they seem to be maybe drained or very stressed. They're asking a lot of questions about it. They're stressing over it. They're worrying about it. You know, what am I going to do about this test coming up? And I don't think I studied enough. And, you know, there's just a lot of rumination and just repetitive sort of thinking about these situations that they continue to participate in, but maybe are not giving them as much sort of joy or happiness as it was before. And so, you know, parents or even teachers start to wonder, you know, well, what's going on there? You know, it's not what we would see as typical depression, maybe, right? Because they're still doing the activities, but they're feeling anxious. You know, it's giving them stress. It's giving them worry that may be excessive. So, I mean, it's kind of a long-winded answer to the question, but for older teens, I think it's a little trickier because we may not see some of the behaviors sticking out as much, but we always want to look at the quality of the functioning. And I think it really comes down to like parents being able to talk to teens and kind of getting a sense of what's going on in their head or what's behind some of their actions. You know, is it that they're worried about what their friends think of them? Is it that they're worried about how they'll perform on a test? You know, and if that is a frequent, you know, worry that almost becomes a fear that is holding them back from doing things or from feeling, you know, successful, then that becomes a concern.
Right. And I think it's important for parents to have their antenna up for this. Like I said, keep those lines of communication open. And I'm just going to put a plug for your pediatrician. I know in my practice, we screen children for mental health concerns. And it's a chance for the teen to talk to a doctor that they may not say to anyone else. Because this is something you may never see in school. This is like the star student, right?
Right.
Yep. So no one's going to complain there.
Right. They're keeping everything together. They have you know, all the stuff going on and they're just going from here to there to everywhere. But then, you know, at some point they get home and they're exhausted and they're overstressed and they can't sleep. And, you know, they're constantly thinking about what else they have to do the next day. And it might be harder for those kids to, you know, express what's going on because they're supposed to be, you know, doing so well and everyone expects that of them and they've handled it, you know, and so it's important to kind of notice, beyond all the activities, how are they also functioning when they're kind of in that downtime?
Right. Your kid may be getting great grades, but if they're always snapping at you, you know, in the room too much, that's a warning sign. Those are red flags.
Right.
So let's talk about the different types of anxiety. Let's define them. And then I'm going to hope to do a deeper dive into social anxiety and differentiate that from what may look like it, but be something else.
Okay. So, I mean, as far as the subtypes of anxiety, you know, the biggest thing that we think of is general anxiety, generalized anxiety disorder. We see that really commonly. And that's just sort of an excessive worry about lots of different things, daily sort of situations or tasks. It's nothing specific that triggers that worry. Then we have separation anxiety, which of course we see in younger kids, you know, which really relates to, you know, an excessive worry or fear about being separated from a caregiver, worrying that something bad will happen if they're separated from that caregiver. And, you know, this can manifest in many situations. It can manifest in school. It can manifest, you know, in even social situations or family situations or things like that. You know, we have what we call, you know, specific phobias. So, you know, this is worry or fear that's, you know, very specific to a certain situation or, you know, it could be public speaking. It could be, I've heard a lot of kids who are like, have a fear of thunderstorms or fear
needles,
of
needles.
Yeah.
Out of my practice.
Fear of doctors. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, very specific fears that are, you know, causing a significant, you know, fear response, and a high level of distress, and social anxiety, which really is, you know, related to a significant fear of any sort of social situation or interaction, worry about how they're being judged or perceived by others, how they'll appear to others, even worry about like their appearance or their bodies. You know, and it really leads to a significant avoidance of social situations, and high levels of distress. And obviously that's pretty significant because we have social, we're, you know, it's socially interacting all the time, right? Right. At the grocery store, at, you know, at home, at school, you know, anywhere we go. And it can really inhibit, you know, the chance to interact and just necessities of having to communicate with people. And it is important to distinguish that from shyness and introversion, which really is not necessarily something that I think is typically could be viewed as not necessarily a negative thing. You know, it's a personality trait, you know, mm-hmm. And some people who are shy or introverted, they don't have a problem with it. It's good for them. It helps, you know, they like that aspect of themselves. And they kind of know how that's how they are, and they can, sort of give themselves the level of social interaction that they need and they feel is appropriate. You know, I think there's many, individuals who may have social anxiety, and that doesn't mean that they're introverted. Right. It doesn't have to mean that they're introverted. Actually, they can be extremely extroverted, mm-hmm. and really thrive on social interaction and seek that. But there becomes a level of, you know, maybe some situation occurred or they're just really unsure of themselves. Their self-esteem is low. And so now they're unsure how to approach a situation. And then that can just lead to this extreme sort of fear and worry about how others are viewing them. And so that's why it can be so sort of debilitating for someone with social anxiety, because as I said, they could actually be really someone that needs that interaction, but they just can't seek it out because of this high level of stress that it gives them. And now they've avoided and they've, you know, sort of isolated themselves. And it can be really difficult.
Right. Does social anxiety overlap with social skills deficits? I mean, are they anxious because they don't have the social skills?
I think for some kids that can be the case. I don't think it's always the case. You know, I definitely think with some kids with, you know, maybe some social skills deficits related to like an autism spectrum mm-hmm. disorder that are high functioning or
ADHD,
of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, there could be sort of a self-awareness that develops that, you know, hey, oh, this is harder for me to kind of make these connections or interactions. And then that could lead to some anxiety, or worry about, you know, interacting with peers. You know, but it doesn't always have to go hand in hand. I think there are plenty of people who are, you know, sort of, again, like kind of those high achieving type A kinds of personalities, extroverted, you know, really out there with a lot of different activities or skills, and but something is hindering them from being able to really show all of that about themselves to other people, even though they want to, they really want to, and they just kind of it just sort of freezes them. And it can be, you know, it can be almost, you know, it can be difficult to kind of distinguish that, you know, I think. But it's definitely a certain category of its own.
You mean social anxiety without social deficits?
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Because I'm thinking of sort of as a rational anxiety and an irrational anxiety. It's very rational to be anxious about something you're not good at.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the treatment would, of course, be to help that child get those skills.
Mm-hmm.
There's a skill deficit, right? That's where you have social skills therapy.
Right.
Or lunch bunch or whatever it is, you know, program. And that's something else parents can do, by the way, if they're seeing their child is struggling, is go to the school and go to their pediatrician. They can go to the school. Some schools have, you know, most schools have a psychologist or a social worker or somebody that can help with either individual or group counseling. Because the social domain, you know, of course, is where this child with social anxiety has to function in, more so than in the home, really.
Yeah. Yes. And most, and, you know, and sometimes it is easier to function at home with social anxiety, because you're in a, you know, situation that you're very comfortable. So yes, it's most important outside of the home. And going back to what you said, I mean, if parents, you know, feel that there's a concern or, you know, that there's social skills deficits or, you know, a social anxiety, you know, it is always important to, I think, you know, have multiple levels of support. So talking to the pediatrician, mm-hmm. You know, and talking to reaching out to the school, even to get information about how is your child presenting in school? Is this interfering with their ability to even, you know, besides socialize, but even learn in the classroom? Or, you mm-hmm. know, many kids have a fear of like speaking in front of other people, you know, whether, so that could be participation, that could be giving a presentation, you know, so that can hinder them, even though they may be, you know, very bright, but they're not conveying their knowledge of the material appropriately. So you want to make sure that the school can understand and support that in different ways. And, you know, another way that they can do that, as you mentioned, is sort of, you know, maybe meeting with a school psychologist or social worker, being part of a lunch bunch or a social skills group that many schools do provide, that can sort of help to make connections with other students who are struggling in that way. And learn different ways to manage that as it relates to them being in school. You know, and lastly, like, of course, you know, social skills therapy or, you know, CBT for, you know, that related anxiety is crucial. If it becomes something that, as we said, like really is interfering with functioning at home, at school, you know, in all these different environments. And so I think having all those levels of support and, you know, and treatment is really the most, you know, the path that's going to lead to the most success. And of course, the family has to be really involved in that.
Yes. I really want to get to that because I know that you work on the family as well. And that is so, so important. But before, I just want to mention one thing, which is that a lot of parents think, okay, my school has a program and my child's in that program, but they may need more than that, that in general, school programs are meant for function in school.
Yes.
And your child needs to function in many domains. And so it's not uncommon to need outside help. And you can speak to the school's, you know, social worker or psychologist and help with those resources as well as your pediatrician. But don't expect the school to do it all.
Yes, that's very key. I mean, with many diagnoses, as we see, you know, it's the school is going to work on, as you mentioned, you know, the child's, you know, presentation and success in school, you know, academically and what they, you know, what they need to do well in school. So it's not going to fix, you know, everything or help everything that's going on in the child's life or things that are going on at home or with the family. You know, but having that support and understanding from the school is, you know, definitely helpful. Cause that can sort of alleviate maybe one area of stress for whether it's like going to school in the morning or, you know, kids who frequently like have to come home or they're stressed about homework or whatever it could be, you know, but when it comes to, as you mentioned, like other, you know, if there's really a level of functioning that's impacted at home, you know, in terms of just the family dynamics, behavior, sleeping habits, you know, eating habits, all of that, you know, just the excessive worry and reassurance seeking that kids can express, you know, of course that would indicate a need for, you know, even further support and psychotherapy. And of course, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is really key to helping anxiety and the family's involvement with that.
Right. So we're talking about getting private counseling in addition to whatever your child receives through the school.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's important. I want to go back a little bit over introversion, because we really didn't like define it or go into it and mention that you can have a parent who's extroverted who perceives that the introverted child has a problem when it's just their personality. So I want to go into that a little bit more, please.
Yeah. I mean, you know, having, you know, those differences in sort of personality traits can be difficult for parents and children. You know, introversion is really characterized by having a focus on your own maybe internal feelings or experiences rather than relying on external sources of sort of stimulation, you know, or excitement. So really, you know, being able to, you know, experience kind of, you know, a sense of contentment with sort of just kind of being with yourself. And a lot of, you know, people might, again, think of that as, you know, that we think of being quiet or shy or reserved, you know. But again, I think it's important to note that I think a lot of, you know, people who would identify as an introvert, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's something, you know, wrong or that they view that as a negative aspect of themselves. It's actually just a part of who they are. You know, so that wouldn't be in and of itself something that we would be concerned about, just as we wouldn't be concerned if someone is particularly extroverted, right? Which means that they're seeking, you know, that outside or external source of stimulation. So they're very outgoing and talkative and lively and active. And when you have, you know, two different sort of very different family members who are presenting that way, it can be difficult, you know, if like, you, as you said, a parent is extroverted and a child is introverted. You know, maybe parents can think that, oh, they might not, you know, my child might not, you know, make enough friends, or they're not, you know, gonna, be involved in all these activities, and that there could be something, you know, that they're concerned about with that, but the child may be content that way.
I think it's even more than that, because I've heard it described that an extrovert is energized by everybody around them and an introvert is depleted. An introvert is energized by being alone and filling their gas tank up again. So I think that really has to be understood for a parent who's an extrovert, who has an introverted child.
Yes, they really, you know, that, as you said, you know, introverts need that time to themselves, just as extroverts need that time, you know, with others and outside of the house or, you know, doing different things. You know, and I've talked to, you know, obviously many kids and family members who, you know, say that to me. It's like, okay, I needed to kind of have my alone time and like recharge and things like that. And that alone time can be very important for some kids and teens. And it, again, it makes it difficult, right, to determine, is that too much alone time? What's going on with that? But I find that often, like, children who, as I said, are teens who can identify in that way, you know, and they can actually say, like, well, this gives me, you know, this helps me. I need this time to myself. And I've had a lot of kids, you know, also express that to me in therapy. And I really reiterate that to parents, as you mentioned, because sometimes, you know, it could be a big push to, like, get out of the house and do different things and be around, you know, especially even like larger groups of people. Sometimes even people who are introverted, they could prefer to just be with one other person, right? Or two other people. And that's fine. That's enough for them. You know, they don't have to be in a huge group setting. And that might even be overwhelming to them, you know? So, parents may not really understand that, and it can cause, you know, some friction and really some, I think, invalidation of, you know, the child's really, like, emotional state and their, you know, the way that they see themselves and the way that they kind of want to, you know, how they're identifying themselves. You know, it's like, I may not need that, even though that's what you may need. And it's tough because parents, of course, only want the best for their kids, but there does have to be a level of, like, an understanding of personalities and temperaments, which do play a role, you know, but again, not always when we're talking about a clinical level of anxiety. You know, that's not to say that that's necessarily going to lead to a clinical level of anxiety.
Right. And I think one way, this is maybe oversimplified, but one way maybe to distinguish is if your child's, you know, spending some time alone, but comes out looking more relaxed and happy, as opposed to your child is spending more time alone and is not happy, is irritable or snapping or, you know, seeming sad. I think right. That's one way. And also if there's been a change, you have a child who's introverted, they've been introverted their whole life. You're not going to see a change.
Yes. Yes.
And you might see, say, a child, I'm sorry, but you may see a child who goes back to school and it spends all day in that noisy, loud, crowded environment and needs to recharge. And you may see after they've been home during the pandemic and then they go back to school, they may seem to be spending more time alone. But again, I mean, I would look at how they're, when they come out of being alone, how they are.
Yes. Yeah. And that's so key. I think the change that you mentioned is key. You know, there could be kids that spend a lot of their childhood, you know, around a lot of other kids and doing many activities and participating in many things. And then, you know, maybe they're reaching like adolescence and they're kind of more isolated and they're seeming to lose connections with others and they're not engaged in as many activities outside of the house. And that's, you know, as soon as you see that change, that's definitely something to be concerned about. That could be a red flag. Of course, we always want to understand why that's happening, right? And again, those lines of communication are important for parents and children. But yes, I think that's key. You know, the personality and temperament of someone who's what we would call shy or introverted is going to be there since, you know, from their whole life, right? So it's not like one day they're just going to become shy or introverted. And vice versa with, you know, someone who's extroverted. So it is important to see that change over time and any drastic changes, you know, in their mood or interactions at home, you know, is definitely something to note. And I think, as you mentioned, like the snapping irritability, you know, that's a huge, you know, thing that a lot of parents always talk to me about. And of course we always think of that in teenagers, right? They can be, you know, not maybe the nicest in the way they're talking to their parents. But I think it's interesting too. We see it even in younger kids, and preteens. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big, you know, kind of warning sign for parents when a child is seemingly irritable very often, you know, more often than not. And I think that's a real indication that there could be some anxiety underneath the surface that they maybe don't know how to express as exactly that. Because I think that's a huge thing that I also work on with kids in my practice is, you know, they may not really understand that as anxiety at all. You know, they come to me and they're like, well, I think about this a lot. And sometimes I have these questions and I worry about that, or, you know, I don't want to, my parents are making me do, you know, do this or do my homework or go to school, but I just can't, you know? And it's like, so it's not this like willful, like, right, I don't want to do it. It's, I feel that I can't and I don't know why. And then we can identify that, well, there's some level of worry and really sort of, you know, irrational and negative thinking going on under there. And then we can kind of work on that. And so it's important to, on some level, help children understand that that's, you know, what that is, what that anxiety, what the feelings that they're experiencing are anxiety or worry. And then that can make it a lot easier to kind of be able to express it and talk about it.
Right. That's a really important point, that it may not look at all like worry. It may look like your kids being a real pain.
You know? Right. And 99% of the time, that's how I get a lot of, you know, families coming in. You know, they're coming in about behaviors, right, or struggles at home. And, you know, once we get to the nitty gritty of things, it's like, well, there's a lot of worry underneath there. There's a lot of questions. There's a lot of reassurance seeking. And, you know, over time, I think kids who are worried and are not sure about either the future or things that are going on around them, you know, they're trying so hard in their own little innocent way to control things around them. And how can they do that? Well, they can do that in silly ways, right? Like controlling their, you know, how much they're playing with their toys or when they have to get off of their devices or, you know, things like that. So it can appear that they're sort of not, you know, that they're behaviorally acting out, when really they're just trying to control any small aspect that they can, because they're pretty nervous about many things. And if parents aren't, you know, by no fault of their own, aware of that, then, you know, it can sort of, you know, it certainly doesn't help the situation. Right. So it's important to look at a lot of, you know, what's underneath those behaviors and actions and moods, you know?
Right. And that's hard when they're pushing your buttons, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's frustrating for parents, you know?
Yeah. I want to get to parents because, you know, I know you do family therapy as well, and it's so, we're already giving a great segue to that, but I wanted to backtrack just a little bit. It's really, these are two separate topics, which you're not going to be able to cover, you know, in this talk, which is really on anxiety, but one is bullying, which can be online bullying. And the other is, well, three, the other is the rise in internet and other social media use. And then the third is just to be aware of just how common anxiety and particularly older children and teens is. So that's three topics that really could be topics of their own, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention them.
Yeah, I mean, definitely important topics that could definitely be covered on their own time.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, the overall, you know, anxiety is definitely more common in children and teens. I mean, it seems to be a rising issue. And I think that the biggest sort of concern, I think, you know, there can be different sort of levels of that, I think. So there's some kids that may be presented with anxiety when they're young and then maybe had some treatment and now it was kind of, you know, managed. And then, right. And then as they get to that middle school, high school age where there's more pressures, there's just more, you know, things going on, that can pop up again, you know, and it can look different. It can present different, you know, so there can be different sort of, stages or, you know, incidents of anxiety for certain kids. You know, certainly I think that, I feel that it's important to mention that, you know, anxiety definitely has a familial genetic component, right? And can be sort of passed on in that way. But also there's, you know, that sort of learned component to the behavioral aspect of anxiety, you know, where families can just sort of, the anxiety can essentially like rub off on each other, you know? And it's especially tricky, I think, in COVID times as well, you know, with the pandemic and, you know, adults themselves are, you know, fearful and worried. And there's so much to consider about what's going on now. What will the future be like? You know, and that all, of course, it's normal to feel that way, but that can rub off on the entire family. And for kids who may, you know, have any sort of predisposition to that, it can really sort of grow into something bigger. So it's tough, you know, it's definitely, a rising concern with all these other reasons why we have legitimate concerns to feel anxiety. And I think the other thing I wanted to mention too, is that with teens, you know, as I think we touched on this before, but, generalized anxiety, you know, is, such a risk factor for depression, you know, and that can quickly lead into depression, you know, in teenage years, just from that intense, like avoidance or isolation and excessive worrying. And they can really start to feel hopeless and helpless at how to sort of fix that situation. So I think it's so key to recognize, you know, if possible, the anxiety, you know, in earlier stages, and recognize the importance of if there's a need to seek, you know, counseling or psychotherapy for that.
Right. And it can be tricky because, like I said, so many of our teens and, you know, young preteens are anxious now. And you mentioned earlier that parents are asking you, could it be the social media, the internet? I know that there are a lot of things written about it that is a big component. We're not, you know, going to delve into that, but it's just important to mention that I've heard it said that teens nowadays have two adolescences. They're in person and they're online.
That's so interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think just for parents to be aware, you know, how much time your kid's spending alone, how much time are they spending on these various social medias and video games, putting aside being a good digital citizen, putting aside safety, you know, this, especially during the pandemic, it can be tricky because they might have to go to school online.
Yes.
Right. They might be remote schooled and they're supposed to be in front of a screen, and that's just going to add on to their social screen use. But I think it's just, it's really important to mention, and it may seem normal, but anxiety, even if everyone has it, is not normal.
No. Yes.
It can't be defined by everyone has it and therefore it's okay. You know, poor functioning, if it's across the board, is not okay.
Right. Right. And for some, you know, that for some families, that's why I was mentioning that it can sort of like rub off on family members, and then they kind of view that as their normal, you know, and then, but it's really not when you look at it. I mean, and we can get into this, you know, maybe, I don't know if you want to get into this now, but there's just so many, sort of, behaviors and, you know, that, that both parents and children engage in that really can, you know, they're inadvertently sort of,
feeding off each other.
Yes. So it's tricky. And that's where the family component of therapy is so important.
Can you give an example? Cause like, I know what you mean, but
yes, yes, of course. So, you know, children with anxiety will find all sorts of, you know, kind of ways to, stave off their levels of discomfort. So they might find like safety behaviors, right? So, I always need to carry this, you know, water with me in case I have the feeling like I'm going to throw up because I'm nervous. So I need that water with me at all times, just in case, you know. A lot of kids I talk to are constantly seeking reassurance from their parents. So checking in with them a lot if they're at work or if they're at school. You know, are you okay? Did you get home? Where are you? What time are you coming home? There's a lot of reassurance seeking. And underneath that, again, is many worries and fears about what could happen. The most common things that I see are what I call, you know, the accommodating behaviors that parents can engage in. Mm-hmm. So what that really involves is, you know, children who have these worries or concerns and parents are offering sort of a quick fix of reassurance. But in the long term, it doesn't help the child to tolerate their distress. So an example that I hear commonly is, you know, my son or daughter won't, you know, go upstairs to take a shower by themselves. I go in the bathroom with them while they take their shower because they don't want to be up there alone. Or, you know, they can't go down in the basement and grab something that they need. I have to come down there with them. Or, you know, they're sleeping in my bed because they can't sleep alone. Right. Or I'm with them in their room while they're falling asleep at night. And ultimately, you know, it comes down to, what the parents, can sort of tolerate. Live with, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like if they themselves have anxiety or they themselves have poor, you know, frustration tolerance, then it relieves their distress to give in to the child.
Yes. And so often that's what's happening, right? Because it's just frustrating. You know, parents are like, well, I need to sleep. So of course I'm going to, you know, let them sleep in my bed because I need sleep, you know? And so, you know, but it really comes down to when I'm working with a family, I'm like, well, what are the things that are distressing to you though? Are these, what parts of it are inconveniencing your life and you're noticing this distress at home? You know, and cause commonly that's what, like, as I said before, that's almost what leads them into therapy, is that there's just this level of distress and sort of chaos at home. And they're not sure why. And then we can sort of understand what's behind those behaviors. So why is your child not wanting to go to the bathroom by themselves? Why are they not going, you know, to able to just lay down and fall asleep on their own? You know, why are they, you know, texting you throughout the day to see, you know, where you are when you're coming home? You know, it's not just a behavior that, you know, because they're just not listening or they're being stubborn. There's something underneath there, you know, and we kind of need to understand that in order to help. And, you know, to be clear, it's like these can be younger kids, a lot of kids who are like 8, 9, or 10. But even teenagers can exhibit some of this behavior sometimes. You know, and so that's when it becomes, of course, concerning. You know, obviously we're not talking about, you know, 2 and 3 year olds, but you know, it becomes, you know, what's developmentally sort of appropriate for the child, you know, at the level of, you know, where they're at, you know, can they be doing these things on their own? And most importantly, you know, it's not so much about, you know, because then it sort of get into a conversation with parents sometimes about, you know, sort of like the right or wrong of like discipline or, you know, managing sort of behaviors and things like that. But that's, for me, that's not the concern. It's more so, you know, what message is that sending to an anxious child, you know, a child who's already questioning themselves or what could be happening around them, right? Well, I'm worried that, you know, something bad could happen to my mom when she's, you know, driving to work. So, you know, you're giving her that quick reassurance of sending a text message or talking to her the whole way that you're riding to work. But ultimately that's sort of validating their concern, right? There needs, yes, I need to be on the phone with you in order for you to see that that's okay. There is something to be concerned about. Something bad could definitely happen right now. It's, you know, and that can be alarming, you know, so those behaviors that we don't necessarily, you know, think of as something, you know, parents don't think of as maybe always such an inconvenience, or they're certainly not doing it to, you know, they're doing it to help. But they're sort of inadvertently validating a lot of fears for the child, and sort of telling that child that, you know, yes, there is a big concern here that you should be worried about, instead of sort of giving the child the confidence to feel that they can do it on their own, or they can work through it, or I can be there to help you. But, you know, ultimately, this is something that you can learn to do yourself. So, you know, I talk with parents a lot about how it's, you know, it can be tricky, because if you're accommodating a lot of worry behaviors and these safety behaviors, you know, you're kind of sending the message that they can't do these things on their own. And and you're kind of inadvertently, you know, it has an effect on their self-esteem, you know, and their confidence over time, you know, and then that carries over, of course, into, as you're saying, like, that could be what's going on at home, then it can carry over into school and other things. You know, so kids who don't, maybe they're having school refusal, they're worried that they, you know, can get sick in school or something bad can happen, you know, and then, so then of course, like picking them up from school, again, just sort of sending the message that, yeah, there's something to be concerned about there and you definitely shouldn't be there, you know, and that's not the message that we want to send. We want to send the message that you're in a safe place, there are people there that can help you, and we'll figure out a way to help you get through that, you know. So all of that is really why I feel it's so important for the parents and family members to be involved in the child's treatment of anxiety. And it's really like two factors. And I mentioned this earlier, but it's like, of course, we're working, you know, in a very sort of more structured CBT approach with a child, to, as I said, understand their worries, understand their maladaptive thinking patterns, and those negative sorts of thoughts and those worries. And
wait, can you define CBT, please? And tell us what it is?
Sure. So cognitive behavioral therapy really works on understanding, you know, the relationships between our thoughts and our emotions and how that, in, you know, then relates to our behaviors. And so many of, you know, a child's, you know, how they're presenting with a range of disorders, but specifically with anxiety, you know, comes down to, you know, we're seeing an anxious behavior, right? We're seeing, you know, an avoidance of something. And so we have to understand, where's that coming from? So there's, of course, with every behavior, there's a matching, you know, emotion, and there's a matching thought. And that's sort of how we look at CBT. And so it's important to help the child understand, well, what, you know, we're avoiding that because we're feeling very worried, and because we're worried because we're thinking that something bad will happen, or we're worried that, you know, we'll get hurt or something like that. There's often a specific, you know, worry thought, and it's important to help children recognize those thoughts, because a lot of times, you know, parents and adults, we talk to kids about their behaviors, we help them talk about their feelings. We don't often, you know, distinguish about their thinking. And that's something that, you know, definitely takes time with kids and practice, but it can be, you know, again, really helpful for them to understand, oh, this is why I'm feeling this way. This is why I'm acting this way. It's because I am always thinking about this, or I have all these questions in my head and I don't know how to kind of, you know, relieve that. So I'm looking for, you know, to just sort of avoid a situation because of that. So the biggest thing that we want to help do with the child in CBT is really help them to learn to face and tolerate that anxiety, not just avoid or get rid of it, right? So we can't necessarily use the language that we're just not going to be worried and it's just going to go away, because that's unrealistic. But we want to help them understand that worry can be there, but we can sort of face it and we can learn to deal with it. And then it may get easier and it may get smaller over time. And so we do that by helping them develop, you know, coping strategies and distress tolerance skills. So, you know, whether that can be like relaxation skills, which can include, you know, sort of mindfulness, being aware of what's going on for them in the present moment, doing some deep breathing, you know, and a lot of, you know, some like physical sort of, distractions, so to speak, like, you know, maybe like, a comforting object, like a stuffed animal or a blanket or, you know, a fidget or something that they can squeeze, you know, something that they can feel around them in that moment that can help them to sort of calm, those anxious feelings, which ultimately in a lot of kids, can look like and feel like panic symptoms, you know, and I don't know if we really talked so much about panic, but you know,
there's so much we can't cover it all.
Yeah, I know. You know, but there's definitely a piece of that even young children experience, you know, and they experience those somatic symptoms, you know, headaches and nausea and their stomach hurting, and those are common symptoms that kids will describe if they are talking about feeling worried. Or again, they may not connect it, and we want to help them connect that to their worry. But that could be often what kids will describe to their parents. Well, my stomach hurts, and I feel like I could throw up, and I have a headache, and I don't feel good. And right. 9 out of 10, it's not that they're sick. It's that right. they're really worried.
Right. And I find that, I mean, but I find that as a pediatrician, that is the scenario that I find myself in every single day. And a lot of times the interpretation of the parent is something's wrong. We have to look into it. And that's where it really feeds into a spiral between the parent and the child. And I hope people are understanding how important it is to get the parent involved, because you cannot do CBT on a child who's worried with ignoring the parents. You can't.
Right. Yes. Yeah, it's a huge, you know, factor, because they're going to be the ones that are responding in the moment to that distress. And so it's hugely important for, you know, the parents to not only understand their child's worry and how that will manifest, right? So whether it is in these physical symptoms, or, you know, they're asking a lot of questions, they're seeking that reassurance, they're engaging in these safety behaviors, you know, and so we have to understand that, you know, we have to help parents understand that. And secondly, we want to help parents to, you know, really model for their kids, right, a healthy level of coping with stress. And, you know, especially I was thinking about this in terms of the pandemic and with COVID and everything. I mean, right. Of course, as I said before, like, adults are concerned, we're worried, we're scared, we didn't know what could happen, we don't know what the future could look like. You know, and it's not to say that we should mask that, but it's important to, you know, when we're now easing back into normal life, right, sort of model that, you know, things can be okay. How can we handle this, you know, and it's sending the message that it's okay to feel a little worried, and we can talk about it, and we can work on it, and we can get through it. But so often it's like, you know, a parent's anxiety about, you know, a child returning to a situation, right, whether it be school or, you know, soccer or something like that, where maybe, you know, in COVID terms, where they're sort of exposed to more kids, you know, can lead to even more sort of fear manifesting in the child, or a sense of not feeling, you know, secure or safe. And we don't want that to, you know, kind of grow into something bigger. Of course, you know, as I said, everyone's going to have sort of a normal level of worry about it. But I think it's important for parents to notice like their body language and the words that they're using when they're talking about, you know, upcoming situations or scenarios, you know, because kids will pick up on that very quickly, how their parents are viewing a specific situation that they're entering.
Right. And that's why it's so important for parents to take care of their own mental health. It may not be enough for the parent to participate in a family therapy to help their anxious child if they themselves are anxious. If they're not capable of modeling resilience, then they need to get the help. Even if it's very understandable to be anxious. I mean, you listen to the news media go on and on about, you know, children in the ICU in the South and we don't have vaccines for children. And of course it leads to anxiety. It's not abnormal.
Right.
To have anxiety. But again, it still boils down to, you know, how you're able to present to your children. If you can't promote resilience and cope with it, then you need to get help for yourself. And there should be no shame in that.
Yes. Yes. So important. You know, and oftentimes, you know, that's something that I see in my practice. You know, I'm sort of, you know, reached a level where a parent might realize that they need to get their own anxiety, you know, kind of more managed to be able to help their child. You know, but, it's, you know, as things sort of kind of return to quote unquote normal life,
whatever that is,
you know, whatever that might be, you know, of course there's always going to be this uncertainty and,
right.
and that's what, especially for kids is hard to understand, you know, for adults even, and even more so for kids.
Right. But they'll learn from us. But they'll learn from us. We have to be able to model that.
Right. Right.
And if we can't, we have to get help for ourselves. Like you can't expect, you know, to heal your child if you yourself are suffering.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. I want to thank you. I'm sorry. You wanted to say something?
No. That's okay.
I promised you it wouldn't be more than an hour and we're over an hour.
Oh my God. I didn't even realize. Oh boy. Okay.
This is amazing. We have so much more to talk about and I'm really hoping that you'll let me interview you again on another subset that we ignored because we really only did a little slice of the pie here.
I know there's so much I can just talk on and on about it.
No, this is amazing. And I want to thank you so much for doing this with me.
Of course.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org. That's JOMA.org. Or email us at health@joma.org.